Stein, who will be speaking on solastalgia, embracing longing for home. Jan is an eco-psychotherapist in private practice in San Francisco and Marin County, and she's also the director of the Holos Institute. She leads workshops and retreats that interweave meditation, active imagining, shamanic journeying, and earth-based contemplations. She is taught at the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology, Sonoma State University, Groff Transpersonal Training, the Bioneers Conference, the Association of Transpersonal Psychology Conference, ESLIN, IONS, as well as many others. For over 26 years, she has maintained a private practice, which includes consultation, individual, and couples therapy. So please join me in welcoming Jan Vilksteyn. Thank
you. Thank you. That's a nice, warm welcome. I'm going to give a shout-out to my Holos interns who are here. Raise your hands. Emily, Michael, Mary Jane. So just in case if you don't know what Holos is, we are actually the only counseling center in the U.S. that's actually practicing principles of eco-psychology and trying to bring that into clinical practice in a community-based, affordable counseling center. And it's also a training program for postgrads getting their hours for licensure. So, and we're in San Francisco, and we're in Oakland. And I'll just give a shout-out for that. Send us referrals. Anyway, so I'm going to be... I'm going to try to give you a soothing afternoon because I know we're all pretty tired here, and I want to give us plenty of time for conversation, for questions, and we'll have a little exercise in here. But mostly, I'm going to be showing you some images, and you know, it's late afternoon. It's a good time to kind of go into a liminal space and just. Take in the images and notice how you're feeling in your body. And I know it's a little warm in here. maybe we'll just pretend we're on a beach in Brazil. when I first started thinking about this program, I kept looking for a story. And I've been looking a myth or a story that described a longing that welled up that would be so strong that one would take action to protect. It's kind of like what a mother bear might do, or as I recall, you know, when my kids were growing up, that kind of fierceness that you take on because you love them so much. And I wondered, how could we translate that action, that felt sense, for the earth, for environment, for place? I recently attended... The Geography of Hope conference, which I highly recommend. They do it annually out at Point Reyes, and it was really wonderful. The theme of it was, what do you love too much to lose, and what would you do to defend it? So it's a good question to have and to hold today while we're doing this. I didn't find the story I was looking for. I spent way too much time searching for it. So then I realized that we have to invent a new story. We have to come up with them. And I think that's some of what Craig touched on this morning. What we're looking for is a story that will shift the paradigm that perpetuates separativeness, greed, apathy. You know, the ills of our society right now is really apparent with greed, hatred, and delusion, the three problems in Buddhism, right, that arise that keep one from consciousness, from connection. And that's what I'm looking for. And in my work with clients, that's what I'm trying to get at. When I consider eco-psychology, I think of it as there are many paths. And I think this has already been touched on today, but I'll just give you my version of it. Let me know if this mic is funky in the back. What? Uh-oh. Okay, there we are. yeah, I'll keep those slides going. Don't worry. Thanks. Let me know when that goes off. I think everyone has a different, their own unique orientation, their own gifts, their own attributes, their own temperament. And that kind of defines how you will embrace eco-psychology, how you will walk path you will walk on that. For me, I'm more in the psycho-spiritual path, and I'm a therapist, so that's what I do. But I'm hoping that there are also scholars, that there's activists. There's room for many people in the room, and we need all kinds of temperaments, and we need a collection of temperaments and avenues to address this on. My work is mostly with clients. Sometimes I take clients outdoors, but I also do a lot of work with groups trying to connect to nature. And I'm always looking for a way to foster a love and a longing for place that breaks through the veil of denial and the associated fears that lie at the deeper level. I once had a shamanic teacher who taught a beautiful lesson on fear and love being opposite sides of the same coin. And very much what we're in right now, we're in a fear-based society. Even as we talk about climate change, fear arises. And if you imagine that you could flip that into love, you might find a path of healing, a path through that. So that's what I'm looking for. As ecotherapists, as eco-educators, eco-psychotherapists, how can we engender that kind of ongoing connectedness? And with that, the reciprocity of care for place in the natural world. So there's a wonderful word. I'll move these slides around in a minute here. There's a wonderful word that describes a love of life called biophilia. And I love this word. It was first introduced by Eric Fromm to describe the psychological orientation of being attracted to all that is alive and vital. And then E.O. Wilson in the 80s used the term in the same sense when he suggested that biophilia describes the connections that human beings subconsciously seek with the rest of life. He proposed the possibility that the deep affiliations humans have with nature are rooted in our biology. And unlike phobias, which are aversions and fears that people have of things in the natural world, philias are the attractions and the positive feelings that people have towards certain habitats, activities, and objects in their natural surroundings. And what I have found over the many years of working with all kinds of psyches is that landscape lives inside of us very deeply. As Craig mentioned today about the archetypes that are very much alive in the outer world, I find so often people describing situations, and even interpersonal situations or intrapsychic problems, using metaphors of landscape. And sometimes in a very deep way, in trance states, I see that emerging very deeply. So I'm going to kind of take us on a little voyage here through some of the landscapes that can live inside of us and look at how home shapes our bodies, our minds, and our spirits more deeply than we can know. The impressions of the outer landscape is alive within us, and we'll carry the impact of that in us. So in a way, one thing I'd like to frame it is landscape mirrors psyche, nature mirrors psyche. So prehistoric people, if you think about it, who long ago, I hope this came out okay, these are mostly in the caves that are in France, where there's amazing paintings. And if you think about it, these were done in the dark. These were people who had had a really incredible encounter with the natural world outside of the cave. And it was in their bodies as an impression. And they came down into these caves to leave their impression, to reproduce it. That's carved into the stone, that horse. So, and in a way, this is what happens. Nature carves into our own psyches, into our own bodies, an impression, and it shapes us. This is the wall of bulls, if you can see that. This is hard to see on here, but there's bulls all around there and horses too. And this is a huge, huge cave. And here it is in the landscape itself, the very thing living now that was seen so many years ago. So I'm always curious what my clients carry of the outer world within the caves of their own psyches. The landscapes live inside of us. And I see this from observation of clinical processes, from encounters in the natural world, which I lead with individuals' ecotherapy and through the group processes I mentioned. So, for example, I worked with a woman who had probably one of the most severely traumatic childhoods I've ever encountered, and was, you know, diagnosed with PTSD. She described her childhood was, her family was very explosive, and when she described the landscape of her psyche, it was seared. It was like a violent explosion that had then hardened into something black and dismal and bleak. She saw nothing in it. But this reflects it. Okay, this is actually from the Big Island of Hawaii, where there's an active volcano flow. And the interesting thing is if you stay with the images enough, there's something that arises out of it. And that's what the work was not to run away from that landscape, but to sit with it long enough until something arose. Yeah, they're amazing images. And you can see all sorts of things in them. And that's part of the beauty of it. Part of her healing came from going into a crack and a crevice in this landscape to contact a being that would heal her. And it was a very powerful, powerful work. There's another woman who had lost a significant relationship and also her home. And so this upturned tree, this is actually a redwood tree, really reflected that to her. This was her state of her psyche, was the upended huge roots pulled out of the ground. And you can see that even in that, there's beauty. And by holding to that shadow place in herself, we could start to see the beauty and the twists and turns and the raw roots. Another person I worked with came into a very active relationship with a waterfall spirit, and this was someone who was very dry in her spirit and feeling kind of empty and lost, and she's started to make a relationship with a spirit that she felt emerged out of the waterfall. And so she would take daily walks to the waterfall and have a conversation with the spirit. And this is someone who was very lonely. And this waterfall healed her. The waterfall gave her the path to walk back to her own healing. I'll stay on that one for a while. And of course, you know, you'll hear a lot of talk about ecotherapy for taking people out into nature to let nature heal that psyche. And I think that's a powerful work, but as eco-psychologists, it shouldn't end there. We're looking for a reciprocity. I'm always looking for, okay, now that this beautiful place in nature has given you something, what will you give back to it? And I think it's an important question to always ask and always keep in mind. It's not a complete psychology until we do that. Because what we're really trying to do is get away from that Cartesian way of thinking and come back into healing the sense of self and other, and that maybe there isn't that kind of division anymore. We see in our own inner worlds, we can all see all sorts of landscapes reflected. And this is an image, it's a plant, but it looks like bones. If you're going through a death or some kind of illness process, this could be a healing image for you. Or the entanglements that relationships can bring. Or the beautiful symmetry of life. An anthole, even, can be evocative. So in the minutiae of life, we discover in nature, we reflect, we find bits and pieces of ourselves. And the imagination begins to run wild. This is actually a madrone tree. But you can start to see, I think, what I'm getting at here is the sense of the mind and the soul projects on nature. And nature gives us back something, and we start to awaken the imagination. It's through that awakened imagination that healing begins. Trillium and a mushroom. Let's eat it. There's also, I love to work with portals. Minutia. Okay. Yes. Yeah, so the patterns on a rock. One could read those as the tablets. And the rocks become alive. And we also start to see passageways, entrances into other worlds. If you start looking around, you'll see portals everywhere, and they're invitations from the natural world to change our state of being. And I'm not going to name what all these things are. This was a spontaneous temple that a friend and I built at the beach one day. There's also liminal spaces that call to our imagination. The walk on the foggy day, or the snowy day. What's going to appear out of the fog that we might not know? We're inspired by vistas, and we're expanded beyond the limits of the ego by great views where we can take and put our life into perspective. And as you can see, there's extroverted landscapes and there's introverted landscapes. There's the deep going inside. There are lines and paths that call us, that move us into new places, inspire us to reach up, to reach beyond what we are doing now, change something, to allow something new to come in, to descend. And then there's the encounters with the animal world, where we begin to perceive the consciousness, the aliveness, the intelligence of all beings, the animals, the trees, the stones, the plant people. And there's an interesting thing that happens if you start noticing what the aliveness in nature, and then allow whatever it is that you're observing to observe you, to perceive you. That turtle is looking at us. If you think about it, the whole world, the whole natural world is actually watching us now. Maybe wondering, what will we do next? So making that connection to as everything being alive, everything having an active consciousness, actually offers a sense of healing that separation between human and the natural world. And you might look and try out what happens when we shift our language, our English language. We say it instead of he or she or they. Try describing your own landscapes in that way, or when you go for a walk next, greet each thing that you see, whether it's a rock or a tree or a plant, a flower or an animal, with a personal pronoun and see what happens. It really shifts things. I had, even that just slight shift in language will make a change in consciousness. I had the good fortune to spend some time with the Yolnu tribe in Aboriginal Australia about 15 years ago now. And this is at the people that live at the very top of the Gove Peninsula in Australia, and they were some of the last of the Aboriginal tribes to be kind of contacted by non-native people in the 70s. And the wonderful thing I learned about their language is that everything is named. Everything is named according to this relationship to that person. So even people, you know, you wouldn't say this is like they didn't know how to take me in. They didn't know how to relate to me until I was there for a while. And then someone said, oh, you're my adopted daughter. And then suddenly I had aunts and uncles and cousins and grandmothers, but also the plants had a name for how they would relate to them, which I found really, really interesting. And they could differentiate in ways that I couldn't imagine. They took a bunch of us white girls out to hunt for fish, actually clams and witchetty grubs and these big long worms that you pull up out of a mangrove forest. And they took us way out into the forest and dropped us off, and we were walking and walking and walking. We all had little buckets and we're gathering up things. And after a couple hours, they said, okay, so we're going to let the white girls tell us where to find the way back. Where's the Jeep? And someone said, oh, it's over that way. No, it's over this way. And they let us go for quite a while. We were starting to sweat it out because we knew we were lost. And then this woman leaned forward and she said, it's over there. She said, it's right behind that tree right there. And we're just like, this is a horizon that's full of trees, right? But each tree was different. Each tree was unique. Each tree had a different name. And it was named not by, oh, that's a eucalyptus tree, but that's the tree that gives me a certain relationship or points the way home or shows me where camp is. And that way of relating to the environment really struck me deeply as what a place of healing, what a way to move into our worlds, move around our world in that kind of respectful way where everything is embodied with life and everything has meaning and a very specific relationship. So really all of us have some cognizance of this at some level, some connection with the landscape that we might not remember, but our bodies remember. And I had an odd thing happen to me. I've lived in California now for 37 years. And a few years ago, and I'm from a rural part of New Jersey. I always hesitate to say New Jersey because it conjures up Hoboken and Newark, but this is South Jersey. This is like, you know, the country. Woodlands, rivers, rolling hills, lots of water, lots of swamp grass. I don't know if anybody's from that area. But, yeah? Oh. It's beautiful. It's a garden state, yeah. So I hadn't been back there in like, I don't know, maybe 8 years. And I went back for my niece's wedding. And so my sister and I had a day to ourselves. And she said, oh, let's just go for a walk. So we went for a walk. I have a sister who's hilarious. And she's a great storyteller. And she's just talks. So, you know, you can get lost with her. So we're walking along. Oh, I found a place where a log that a beaver had split. I thought that was fun. We were walking through this landscape. This actually wasn't a place I had been to before, but it's very similar. And we're walking along, and all of a sudden, I realize my body felt different. And there's, I think everybody has some experience of a certain buzz or level of tension in your body and your nervous system. I think it's part of being a modern human. I noticed it fell away completely. And it wasn't just being with my sister after, you know, not seeing her for so long. It was really the landscape. I recognized the landscape. I could name the bushes and the flowers there more easily than I could in California. And the landscape really spoke to me. It was in my body. It was in my bones. It was not in my head at all. So I found that really interesting. So, whoops. I'll go back here. Oh, shit. This is Thomas Cole, Voyage of Life. I don't know if you know, from the Hudson Valley School. When I was a child, I found his series of The Voyage of Life, and that always struck with me, and I was able to find this one for childhood. So I'm going to take pause right now, and I'm going to ask us all to just take a moment and close your eyes and let your body remember some place that you just love, some place in nature that's greatly nourished you. And if for some reason that's not available to you, then make it up. This could be from a child, your childhood, or perhaps, if it's not there in your memory, some place that you've known at any point in your life. Just close your eyes and fill out the image. Let all of your senses recall this place. Can you remember the scents? The touch? The colors? Can you remember how your body felt in this place? Take a moment to notice who you see there. And let the memory fill all of your being. And in your mind, take a gentle note of all the aspects of this place. And as you name these aspects internally, I invite you to use the pronouns of gender. Try noting he or she or they were there. And now take a moment and notice what your body feels right now in this moment. Okay, then gently open your eyes. And I'm going to invite you to move into pairs and each take 5 minutes to describe that landscape to your partner. And if we don't have an even number in here, it can be three people, but try to do it in two and just talk about it without interpreting it, without analyzing it. What was that landscape? What did you feel? And then when you listen to your partner, take a notice of what you feel, what comes up for you. Notice what you notice about them when they're sharing, okay? So, okay? I'll give you 5 minutes and then I'll ring a bell and when it's time to switch. Okay, let's come back to the whole group. Thank you for doing that. Yeah, you can take your seats. So I'm curious, any feedback? What did you notice? A place you love. Thank you. Psychology and EMDR or brain spotting is we cultivate what we call a safe place or resource place, and it's often just that. It's a place that's so easily recalled, and it can recalibrate the whole limbic system. It's amazing, isn't it? Yeah, and to think about all the different kinds of people, and even walking around, you know, there's desert people, and there's some people that are going to describe apple orchards, and some people are going to describe oceans, and it's all and it says something about your psyche. Yeah, what were you going to say? Yeah, you know, and in a way, what you were describing was an intimate relationship, you know, a relationship with a lover. And aren't those wonderful to talk about? Lovely. Did anyone try to describe the experience using the pronouns? He, she, they? Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for bringing that up. It's the longing. It's like when we really allow ourselves to sink into this, we contact this deep longing that place has in us. And so many of us are transplants now, you know, so we don't get to have that kind of rootedness, that foothold. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
Well, when she says that, she reminds me, she asked me, how about self-planned, and we never needed one.
Yeah, you could just be.
Yeah.
But imagine that we could still do that today.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's one of the things I love to do with groups when we have, especially an extended amount of time in nature. I find, if like a week, we have a week in of an experience, people finally allow themselves to play and really just be, where there's so much self-consciousness and self-awareness that goes on initially when people walk into nature. And I also notice, if you take a walk, you pass hikers and they're not there. They're talking about something at work or a relationship. And it's amazing to just get these little snippets. But it's lovely to just arrive, to really allow yourself to be. So it sounds like for the most part, everybody liked that. So take a note how you're feeling right now in your body. Oh, yes. Hi. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. You know what you're all bringing up is how much you love a place. And you don't even, might not even go around consciously thinking of it, but it's in your bones. And so I want to bring you back to, my original question, which is, what do you love too much to lose? What would you do to defend it? If you knew that the landscape you just described and contacted was being harmed or altered in some way, would you be willing to take some action? So let's shift a little bit. I don't mean to bring you down, but reality. Yeah, this is, the ideal, right? The golden child being protected by the angel, moving out along the river of life, and it's a surreal landscape. It's just so rich. But what I think that Cole actually experienced the Hudson Valley this way. I think this was his truth. But here's another truth, sad truth. Fire in the Gulf, oil spill. There's an amazing photo of a surfer with trash in the ocean. I'm not going to I'm not going to hit you up with all the things that are there, but there's something to notice what your body feels and how you shift as you look at these images. Oil fields. Haiti. I think it's a slum. And every inch is covered. Clear cut. This is in British Columbia. This is in the Amazon. They're clearing the forest so they can have cattle grazing. I don't know if you know it, but in Brazil they have a rule. I think it's for every head of cattle that you have to have 2 hectares of land for them to graze on. Well, that's great because it means you're getting range-free beef, but the reality is it's not sustainable, and they're cutting into the forest. There's only the Atlantic rainforest. I think there's only 10% left, and it has the richest biodiversity on the planet is in the Amazon rainforest.
It's also the lungs of our.
Yeah, yeah. I'm at the Atlantic rainforest. Yeah, this is. These are fields. I think this is in China, agricultural fields, greenhouses in Spain, shopping mall. I think this is in India. Wow, what a landscape, huh? Cattle lots. This is Mexico City, the outskirts of Mexico City. And again, oil spill. Sorry, the light doesn't allow us to really see the images as I would like them to be. So what do you notice feeling right now in your body?
Dissociation.
Pain? Drained, yeah. Contracted. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to bring you down, but I think it's important for us to notice what the polarity is and what the differences are. The reality here is, you know, there's a collective shadow. There's a great fear of death that drives greed and aggression. I think it also brings about an apocalyptic anxiety. And somebody said dissociated. I mean, there's a numerous psychological defenses, right, that arise when we see these. Disassociation is probably one of the primary ones in this moment. There's a wonderful professor, Glenn Albrecht, you might have heard. He's a professor of sustainability at Murdoch University in Perth. And he described psychoteratic diseases. So these are like disease processes that are involved with, you know, the psyche and land and terra. Eco-anxiety, you know, the kind of just, man, I'm really anxious about where the water is going to come next year. There's nature deficit disorders. You've probably all heard of Richard Liu, who wrote Last Child in the Woods. It's what we get when we don't have enough time in nature. Eco-paralysis. I think that's when we just kind of freeze up and we can't do anything. We're just stuck, and we're just accepting it. And solastalgia is the homesickness you have when you're still, you feel sick about a place, but you're still at home. And he did some wonderful studies in Australia where there's a huge strip mine that had moved into a community, and they measured anxiety and depression in the community. And this was a fairly healthy community until the strip mine went in, and the people felt despair, depression. That's that kind of collapse. It's almost like an internal collapse. Then there's eco-nostalgia, which is more kind of a longing, and I think we can lump into that homesickness. You're away from home. I get this. I like to travel, but then about a week into it, I start to really long for home, and I want to get home again. You probably feel that too. It's just, and you're not quite right until you get home. They do that with vets. Vets are the people in the army. You know, they get homesick, and so they send them home to have a leave so they can get a taste of their homeland, and then they send them back to the war. But it's different. And then there's that global dread, which is what is happening to this world. These are all the diseases that we could have. So he describes, Albrecht went on, and he by the way, coined this phrase, solastalgia, from the Latin noun, means comfort, solacium, and the Greek root for algia, pain. So it means the pain experienced when there's no recognition that the place where one resides and that one loves, when there's a recognition that it's under immediate assault. It's a form of homesickness one gets when one's at home. That's what Albrecht says. You feel desolate about the loss of a loved environment and helplessness in the fear of its destruction. And the problem that happens in this, you can see, it's a very negative cycle. There was talk about on the panel this morning about solace. Well, the desolation that happens to the landscape leads to a loss of solace, which then leads to isolation. People shutting down, communities breaking down. And the longing is lost. The power, the longing is there, but the power, the potency of that longing is then lost as an active force. So what I should have named this talk was actually solophilia. And remember, philia, I love this word. It was one of there were four ancient Greek words for love, and one of them was philia, which is brotherly love, or, you know, kinship love. So solophilia really means the love of the totality of our place relationships and a willingness to accept in solidarity and affiliation with others, the political responsibility for the health of Earth and our home. And in this concept, in this action, solace is secured. There's a love of unity. There's a solidarity. And I think this is a lot about what I heard this morning in the panel. And I think this is a big piece of our work as ecotherapists, ecopsychologists, ecoactivists, eco-resilience builders, workers, educators, is to find a way where we can engender solophilia. How can we help people build communities? How can we help people unite? I was struck this morning, I was remembering, this will date me, but late 60s and early 70s, there was a lot of grassroots organizing that actually went somewhere. You saw something come out of it. And I don't see much of that now, although Obama, for better or worse, was a really good grassroots organizer. That's how he came into power, by just going door to door. I mean, grassroots organizing. I would like to see more of that. And it's part of our role, too, as, you know, ecotherapist, is actually to support people doing that work so they don't get burnt out, so that they feel a sense of solidarity and that their solace is secured. So there's a wonderful artist, Kate McDowell. I think she's in Florida. She does these sculptures, and the series is called Cautionary Tales. But what I love is how she blends human and the animal world and really brings home our connectedness with them. This is a great one. There's a word in Portuguese, or Brazilian Portuguese at least, saudade. I don't know if you all know saudade. It's a great concept. It's when you're just longing for something. It's so deep in you. You crave it. You long it. You have saudade. I'll bet the places that you touched today when we did this exercise, what you may have contacted was actually your saudade for that place. That's an energy. That's an energy that can be activated, it can be called upon, it can be used. Your longing for place can actually heal, can bring our hearts back, bring back the birds in your lungs. I love this image. There's another one, a human and a rabbit.
What's her name again?
Kate McDowell. Yeah, lovely work. Okay, so I'll take you back to a place that I love. This is a place of great solace for me. This is in California, because I don't want the slides to linger on difficult images here. It comes to me. I'm still an optimist. I have hope, and I feel like we're perched on an evolutionary threshold, and it's pretty hard to see the forest for the trees right now. But you know, we're teetering on the edge of a collapse of ecosystems that we know and love, but perhaps the tipping on one edge might be connected to the success in exceeding the consciousness, the reorganization of psyche to inhabit a new collective psyche that is reflected in the individual consciousness, one that not only embraces interconnectedness and a recognition of a world ensouled, but one that is fundamentally rooted in an interdependent and less separative awareness. What if, as a species, we're actually moving towards that? We might think about that. I recently heard someone from Harvard, I think he was an ethicist, and who was very hopeful and felt that people were evolving and that people were actually getting better. And the interviewer challenged him, and he said, look, with ISIS, bringing up the example of ISIS, and he said, oh, no, look at this. Many years ago, there were lots of beheadings and hangings. And the beheadings were actually entertainment. People had a different reaction to it. You looked forward to going. I know it sounds sick, right? But beheadings were part of entertainment. Now we see beheadings and we're repulsed by it. The human being has a different reaction to it. And I think we need to look at that. It really struck me when I heard him say this, because it's an indicator that our consciousness may well be evolving. So I think it's imperative for us as educators, as therapists, activists, to hold a vision of this new awareness, to offer it in subtle and maybe not so subtle ways to people we work with as an alternative and a relief to the myopic and Cartesian view of the world. Let's find a way to engender longing for place that's so deep that it exceeds anxiety and grief and activates action, hope, love. I know I think it's a challenge if you're a psychotherapist, because we spend so much time focused on that client's individual experience and rarely have the opportunity to step them out and look at their context in which they live. But I think it's actually an ethical responsibility for us as therapists to do that. That's the evolution of psychotherapy too, and partly what I love about this field is feeling the courage to challenge people on their actions and what they're on their relationships to the world. And one way of doing it is to obviously to enhance and deepen their connection to the natural world. But the other way might be to just ask them what they're doing. And I'm surprised in my work, I see more and more people with eco-anxiety, but things like a woman I was working with who tends to a whole apartment building, and she's very, very depressed and always anxious and upset, and it turned out it broke her heart to see what people were throwing away. So she goes through the trash can once a week and takes things to the homeless shelter. She just sorts everything. She upcycles and recycles everything from a whole apartment building in San Francisco. And I watched her psyche change from one of learned helplessness and despair and depression to actually having some agency in the world. These are small things, but I think it's important to do. It's important to keep that in mind. So let's find ways to engender longing for place that's so deep that it exceeds anxiety and grief and activates action, hope, love. So I have a quote here from Bill Plotkin, who I highly recommend if you don't know his work already. He's from the Animas Institute and works in Colorado and does a lot of work connecting people, looking at ways to connect people with the landscape. The developing field of eco-psychology offers us nothing less than the opportunity to make a fresh start with Western psychology by taking an ecological and holistic look at ourselves in an era where the revealed interdependency of all things is radically reshaping every field of knowledge. What might we recognize or discover about the human psyche, the totality of our psychological capacities, both conscious and unconscious, when we allow that we too are expressions of nature's qualities, patterns, and motifs. In all cultures, in all lands, we're now being summoned by the world itself to make urgent changes to the human project. But most central is a fundamental revisioning and reshaping of ourselves, a shift in consciousness. We must reclaim and embody our original wholeness, our indigenous human nature, granted to us by nature itself. Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, what we can see in those patterns. It's like the archetypes that emerge in nature. It's exactly that's it, yeah. Yeah.
Who is living somewhere else? We all are with that kind of grief.
Yeah, and I think if we go back to that model of solace and unity, that's where the answer is. I mean, how if you feel that in your own community, you see that happening, to speak up, but to gather up community around it. The concern is there. And I think the time is ripe. People do respond. They just need to have it pointed out. And you're right, years and years ago, right, we didn't, in New Jersey, we didn't think about that. I too had a creek that I grew up at the block from my house, and I spent every day there. And in high school, I did a junior high, I did a mapping project on the erosion of the way as the went around curves, and then in high school did a chemistry project. We took a canoe and took water samples and sampled for toxins all the way out to the Delaware River. And I wish, I knew then what I knew now. I would have had some voice. I would have stayed vocal. I would have stayed on it. But I think we need people to be encouraging. And even if it's somebody that's not in your neighborhood, just the fact that you sat here with this room full of people who connected so deeply to their landscapes from their childhood, I hope that gives you some sense of power and agency You know, let's turn around learned helplessness.
Yeah. But you know what? When you, as you're saying that, I'm thinking about family systems and family therapy, right? The secrets that family, dysfunctional families keep, and they don't talk about it. And then there's someone from the outside, whether it's a therapist or a friend or school counselor, that does an intervention or gives some space for the truth to come out. And in a way, maybe that's what we're doing right now. That's where eco-psychology is moving into that field, right? We're trying to reveal dysfunctional systems at a greater level. Yeah, but you're right. There's just, it's hard to move into a sense of action and even being awareness. Yeah. I don't think it's so much about the words. The words are words. It's the meaning beneath the words, and fundamentally, it is grief. Yeah. There's an old eucalyptus tree out in a side canyon of Tennessee Valley. I don't know if anyone remembers this. Maybe 10 years ago, I used to walk there probably twice a week, and sit under this tree. And there was a pair of great horned owls nested there. And this tree was huge in my world. It was really my temple. And it was a place of prayer. It was where I reconnected and kind of reoriented myself. And the Park Service got onto this eradicate non-native species kick. And I walked out there one day, and there was this huge machine, and the tree had been cut down. And I don't think I've ever had a reaction like this. I couldn't walk at first. I fell on my knees, and I was like, oh, my gosh, I'm going to have to crawl out of here. It's about a mile out. And I made it out. But the interesting thing was, I was grief-stricken, and then I felt helpless, right? I couldn't move. And then I got my feet under me, and then I got angry. I mean, I was smoking. And I got back, and I was calling everybody I could get my hands on. And then, I mean, I was even, I bought a can of spray paint. I was going to go out there at night and spray paint the machine. But then a friend said, you know, you might get in trouble for that. So I didn't go that far. But I got word to it was actually a woman ranger who had ordered it. And a friend, so I had lots of people calling because I couldn't get through to her. And finally, a friend of mine got through to her, and she said, yeah, I heard about your friend. Please tell her, I'm so sorry. The moment I cut it and the owls flew out, I knew I had done the wrong thing. So an interesting story. I mean, partly I tell you that, but it's not the words, it's the feeling, right? And I went through a cycle, and my anger gave me the energy to take some action. I couldn't save that tree, but they didn't. They've left alone the, we call that the grandmother tree, and the grandfather is on the other side of the valley, and they haven't touched that one. In fact, they haven't cut any of them since then. So, yeah. Because it's a non-native species, and it chokes out plants, undergrowth. Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. And I think the thing is, it's exactly that. How do you keep your heart open to love? It's a constant effort, and I think... Yeah, but isn't that is the suffering of our life, though, right? Was it someone said, I heard recently said, death is being born. Okay. Yeah. You know, from time to time at Holos, we have staff retreats, and the best ones are the days that we do the whole day on the mountain. We just had one. I thought it was great. Everybody drops down and is just real.
in a different way than when we're inside a space, an office space. Yeah. I find more often than not it's welcomed, you know, and to not make the assumption that it's taboo. I had an experience many years ago. My mother had cancer, and I was 28, and we didn't mention. I mean, we talked about she had cancer, but nobody talked about her dying. And I flew back east. And she and my dad came down to Washington, D.C., and a friend from college hosted a lunch with us and who knew my mom. Everybody liked my mom. We're sitting there at lunch, and my very outspoken friend said, so, Mrs. Edel, how do you feel about dying? And I remember my father and I just went, oh, my gosh. You know, we just wanted to, like, sink into the floor. And my mother's body relaxed like I hadn't seen it in ages. And she said, thank you so much for asking that. And then she started talking about what it felt like. She knew she was dying, and she talked about it. And later I said, Mom, I hope that was okay. She said, that was the best thing. I wanted somebody to be honest with me, and I couldn't bring that up. I needed somebody else to do that. And I think it's the same situation. And it doesn't, you know, we don't have to clobber people over the head with it. I mean, a couple months ago, I went into some store. It was something very ordinary. I was buying something, and the shopkeeper said something about, I said, something, nice day, isn't it? You know, and he said, yeah, it's a really nice day. And the next day, and the next day, and the next day, and the next day. And I went, yeah, it's pretty freaky, isn't it? And he said, yeah. And this is not somebody I would have expected to be even thinking about it, but people are. And I really see it in my practice. I mean, it just in the last year, there has been a significant shift in terms of how much this plays out, even in people's dreams. So it's in the unconscious, and you see it. I hear more dreams about, natural disasters and things that have the signature of climate change in it. It's in the psyche. And it's, I think people unconsciously are begging to have it addressed. So I encourage you to do that. Oh my, so many.
Talk about the weather.
Yeah, talk about the weather. Yeah. Yeah, and that doesn't serve us, you know, the finger pointing. It's just more of the same kind of divisive Cartesian psychology, right? Us and them.
Well,
maybe they need educating. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, part of why we're in the mess we're in is, you know, Jung talks about the feeling function. And this culture, this country, has a very wounded feeling function. If the feeling function was intact, it would be quite different. We have quite a different situation. So that's what I'm trying, at least in my work, to heal. Yeah. Yeah. It's hard. I mean, the plant kingdom, I think, offers so much. It's so gracious, right? And if you harvest the broccoli, more will grow. I mean, I've noticed that. I have collard and kale plants that are probably 3 years old now. They just keep going. But they need to be, and my tomato plants, too. If I stop picking the tomatoes, it stops making tomatoes. So there's a very particular relationship in the plant world. I think it's the animal world that I'm, and how we abuse and, you know, take so much. I have to say, I've been enjoying these flowers. They're really fragrant, and you at least come and smell them and, you know, appreciate them. I think. Thank you so much. Thanks for bearing with my slideshow. Hopefully you had a little journey on that with that. I'm going to turn it over to Laura, and then Janice and I are going to do a little closing ritual for the longer break before the evening piece.